as was World War I, but that the actual nature of how the avalanche is triggered matters. So whether he dies in an assassination or whether he dies 9 months earlier, World War I in history will unfold slightly differently.
You're listening to Brian Kloss on Chaos, Chance, and Choice. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
We can also see the sand pile model in the Arab Spring. The trigger for the Arab Spring is a man named Mohamed Bouzizi, who lights himself on fire in central Tunisia. He's a vegetable vendor who is upset with the dictatorship he's living in. He lights himself on fire, and this triggers mass protests in Tunisia, which spread. It leads to the Syrian civil war. It leads to multiple regimes collapsing, all triggered by a single vegetable vendor. Now, that's because the sand pile was so tall. If a single person lights themselves on fire, God forbid, in Northfield, Minnesota, or in Norway, it's unlikely to provoke a massive civil war. And so this is the kind of stuff where the interaction between small changes and the sort of social dynamics of the sand pile model play out in more or less catastrophic ways. We've seen this more recently because in 2021, a single gust of wind pushed a boat sideways in the Suez Canal, and it caused about $50 billion of economic damage. Now, it was completely impossible for one boat to cause so much economic damage in the past, but we created a really tall social sandpile by creating systems in which there's no slack, right? Our just-in-time trade and globalization and so on, the ripple effects are magnified from a single boat in a strategic place. So we've made ourselves more prone to the risks of flukes. Now, this is something where I think we don't understand this always because we live in a very different realm from how the social systems used to exist in the past. So what you're seeing on screen now is thinking about the vast stretch of human history as a single 24-hour day. Now, humans, depending on when you measure it from, and there's disagreement about this, we're roughly 255,000 years old, right? Modern Homo sapiens. So if you graph that onto the sort of different ages that I've picked here and then put them onto a 24-hour day, we're in the hunter-gatherer age for about 23 hours, right? The agrarian age with the rise of farming only lasts, it's the last sort of, you know, 55 minutes. And then we get into the industrial age, 1 minute and 17 seconds, and the information age, which we live in now, is about 11 seconds on this clock, right? So we are living in a world that is profoundly different from the way in which our brains evolved and which our societies were initially formed. And that's really important because we have this idea of the illusion of control, which is derived from the fact that our brains were forged through evolutionary history for hundreds of thousands of years to gravitate towards simple patterns of cause and effect, like I was talking about with the saber-toothed tiger example. But we live in a vastly different world, right? In the sort of, you know, 100,000 years ago, the nature of cause and effect didn't change that much from one generation to the next. You know, parents would always teach their children how to hunt or how to gather, and they could teach their children how to hunt and how to gather, and it would be the same. We have, for the first time ever in the last few generations, completely inverted that, right? We've created a world in which children teach parents how to use technology rather than the reverse, and in which the underlying nature of cause and effect is changing year to year, right? With AI now coming in, or the internet, or computerization, the ways that our systems function are constantly morphing. And we have this brain that is basically supposed to imagine that the world is the stable realm of straightforward patterns of cause and effect. So we now have this mismatch between what we understand in terms of how we try to interpret the world and how the world actually is. And the illusion of control, it's a term I coined, is this idea that we have been given that because never before in human history has the day-to-day life that we live been more stable and regular and ordered, and has the overwhelming aspects of cause and effect, the sort of superstructure of our world, been more fragile. So let me give you an example of this. You have, on the one hand, we know that Starbucks, anywhere that we go to, is basically going to have the same coffee, right? We can use Google Maps to figure out how quickly we'll get somewhere. We can order something from Amazon and have pretty high levels of certainty it will arrive when it says it will. At the same time, you know, a single person gets infected in Wuhan and the whole world changes for years. Or you have an election that shocks everything, or you have the Arab Spring. So the overwhelming, the dynamic that we live in is exactly the opposite from the past. In the past, people couldn't control the day-to-day life. They might die from a famine or get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, but the world didn't change. We now have the illusion of control because our day-to-day life is extremely stable, but our superstructure of the world is constantly in flux. And so this has created an upside-down world. I have a line in Fluke where I say, we've invented an upside-down world where Starbucks never changes, but rivers dry up and democracies collapse. And so I suggest that we should probably try to do something about that and try to flip that a little bit more back to how it was. So we have more serendipity in the day-to-day life and less catastrophe in the sort of superstructure of our societies, as it were. I want to close in the last few minutes before I open it up to Q&A. How do we deal with this, right? So I'm painting this picture of chaotic dynamics, instability, chance encounters, small details mattering. What do we do about this? Well, the first lesson, I think, of the worldview that I'm suggesting is that we should stop trying to squeeze every single last drop of efficiency out of a system and instead focus on resilience more. So if you think about optimization in the concept of the sandpile model, if you optimize to the absolute limit, as they did with the Suez Canal, with trade routes and so on, any tiny mistake can be amplified and create catastrophe. Whereas if you focus on smaller social sandpiles that are designed for resilience, such that the little details are less likely to cause avalanches, you're not going to have as many catastrophes. That's one of the big lessons, is that I think we've engineered a world that is fixated with optimization, both in our societies and in our daily lives, where we have sort of, you know, life hacks and ever, you know, regenerating to-do lists and so on. We need to focus a little bit more on resilience, not the stuff that's like the last 3% of efficiency that makes us more prone to social shocks and flukes that can upend our world. The other thing that is the lesson of this. This is the life advice that my grandfather gave me, but some of the best advice I've ever been given. He said the key to a successful life is to avoid catastrophe. I think it's rather good advice. And I think our society should learn from this more. And we should have some of our political sphere devoted to avoiding catastrophe rather than trying to always stretch for optimization. I think we don't do very well with rewarding politicians who plan for a rainy day, as it were. The other lesson is to experiment more. And this is one of the aspects of how you, if you can't understand the world because of chaos theory, if you can't forecast the future very well, then a really smart solution to that is to try experimenting. If you were to understand everything about the way the world works, then yes, optimize to the limit because there's no uncertainty, there's no question or puzzle or mystery. If, on the other hand, you don't understand how the world works and you might get it wrong, you had better try things. You better experiment. And I'll give you a great example. One of my favorite from modern history is about a jazz pianist, Keith Jarrett, one of the best jazz pianists of all time, who was going to give a concert in the Cologne Opera House a couple decades ago. And he's a bit of a control freak with his piano. He wants the exact right piano. And when he arrives at the opera house, it's not the right piano. Somebody has mistakenly not ordered his piano. And so all that there is available is this rickety old mess that's used for practice. It's not fit for a concert. This is a couple hours before the concert. So Jarrett just decides not to cancel. He says, I'll do my best. And he has to experiment with this new instrument. He's forced to experiment because he's forced out of his comfort zone. He's forced out of a world of control. He plays a little bit differently. His music changes a little bit. And this recording, the live recording of the Cologne concert he gave, is still the best-selling jazz album of all time. Because forced out of that world of top-down control, he produced something he couldn't know that he was capable of producing by adjusting himself to this rickety mess of a piano. And I think that provides a parable for society and for our own lives, is that we don't always know what the right answer is. So forced experimentation in a world of uncertainty is a good, good way of navigating through flukes and avoiding some of the most damaging aspects of a world that's prone to them. The final thing I'll say before I open up to Q&A is that we also need to remember that flukes and uncertainty are actually where some of the joyful bits of life live, right? So if you think about a world in which you had a spreadsheet laid out for you at birth, where they say you have a 14% chance of marrying this person and a 27% chance of going to Carleton, you know, all of this would be terrible, right? Like the idea that top-down control and certainty is utopia is exactly the opposite. I think it's the most dystopian idea ever, is if we knew exactly how the world was going to unfold. So the uncertainty is actually, I think, in some realms of life, can be a positive. And it's a different way of thinking about the world, where I draw finally from bringing us back to the butterfly, the humble butterfly, not with the butterfly effect, but with the migration patterns. And it's how I think about a world in which, you know, we're this little cog in the vast cosmos of, you know, 13.8 billion years of flukes that create this moment. The butterflies migrate across, you know, from Michoacán in Mexico up through North America, but they don't end up making the entire journey. They die along the way. And their offspring start wherever their parents died. And so the journey that they produce is creating the conditions for their next generation. And I think one of the things that's really beautiful and uplifting about this idea that all these little ripple effects matter and reshape the world is that we're like these butterflies, right? That everything that we do is determining the trajectory of the butterflies around us, but also the future generations. Where we end our journey and how we leave it is how the next generation starts theirs. A lot of the self-help industry tells you that the way you get happy is by controlling more of the world. And I don't believe that's true. I think the way that you get happy is embracing the influence that you have on the world. And I think that's where the worldview of accepting flukes and the sort of arbitrary and chaotic nature of our existence can actually be extremely uplifting and positive as a way to understand this incredibly maddening and beautiful place that we call our planet. So I'd be delighted to answer any questions you have.
Brian, one topic that came up, both from a registrant, but also here in the chat, has to do with legal culpability. To put it one way, what do you think of when you hear the phrase that somebody deserves something, or to put it in the terms of determinism and free will, what does fluke and chaos theory have to tell us about whether we are responsible for our actions?
Yeah, so I tried to tackle some pretty big philosophical questions, and I'll just say that we don't know the answer to these questions. I don't know whether free will exists. I have this worldview in which every tiny detail of the world matters, but that we don't have free will, right? We can't change them. So, and the reason I believe that is, in a nutshell, I believe that my mind and my brain are the same thing. I believe, and lots of people disagree with that, right? If you're religious and you believe in a soul, then you're going to have a different viewpoint on this. But I believe that my mind and my brain are the same thing. So therefore, I think that my mind is the byproduct of chemical reactions in my brain and my body. I can't control them. So the idea that my thoughts are somehow magical and are separated from the physical matter inside of me, I find bizarre. As a result of that, you sort of think, okay, how do you deal with things like punishing people if there is no free will? And there's a good way of thinking about this, I think, which is we don't believe that hurricanes or tornadoes have free will, but we try to stop them. And I think the way that you would still think about criminality in a world where you accept a lack of free will is you'd say, we still need to stop social harm. It's just that punishment is not tied to what someone deserves. It's tied to minimizing social harm. And I think, you know, ultimately, it's an unknowable question. It's a philosophical belief based on logic. Neuroscience might help us, but at the moment, I think it's impossible to answer.
You've already talked in many ways about all sorts of theories, you might say economics and statistics and social sciences. Can you talk a little bit about physics and the extent to which quantum theory in general helps explain or limits our understanding of chaos theory?
Yes. So this is something where, you know, I interviewed several theoretical physicists when I was researching this because it's not my background, but I read a lot of stuff on quantum mechanics and interviewed some of the leading experts on it. All of them will agree that we don't know what's happening at the quantum level. I mean, we have some level of understanding that, you know, there's equations that govern the atomic and subatomic level that allow us to predict certain things, but interpreting what it means is pretty much impossible. There's some physicists who have the viewpoint, it's the famous quote is shut up and calculate, you know, stop asking the questions, just calculate the equation. Now, it does matter for questions about determinism, because if the world is deterministic, then that would be challenged by what's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is a fundamentally indeterminist theory. But I don't think this solves the free will question. So some people will say, oh, the world is not determined because quantum mechanics shows that these random effects actually happen. Randomness is not free will. Randomness is that we're puppets of randomness, right? So it doesn't actually solve that problem. And some of the quantum mechanics, you know, some of the people I interviewed, Sean Carroll, for example, who has a very excellent podcast called Mindscape, I interviewed him about this, and he's a proponent of what's called the many worlds interpretation, which people who have watched films about the multiverse will recognize, which is basically this interpretation that the math supports in its simplest form, that is basically the world is infinitely branching into an infinite number of universes. I don't know the answer to any of these questions. I gave my best shot at how you sort of incorporate them, but I think you sort of just say it's a wash. We can't know. So how do we make sense philosophically of the world in which any of these things might be possible? And that's what I tried to do.
Great. Yeah. To reverse the standard phrase, dice do not play God, is what you're saying?
There you go. Yes. Yeah. Well done.
How do you get people to do that in a world that is focused on short-term goals, or how to make resilience a short-term goal? Maybe that's one way of thinking about it.
Yeah, so I think there's two ways of thinking about this. One is on the social level, one's on the individual level. So on the social level, I have an example that I think illustrates this pretty clearly, which is there was a country in Latin America that was deciding how to set up its power grid. And one proposal was to maximize efficiency and minimize cost, and that meant a national grid. And the second proposal was to create regional hubs, right? And the idea was this was going to be way more expensive and way less efficient, but it would mean that if there ever was a catastrophe, it would be isolated. And lo and behold, they went for the more expensive, less efficient option, and there was a blackout pretty quickly, and it minimized the economic damage because it was isolated, right? And it instantly paid for itself. But on the short term, it was a bad bet. On the long term, it was a very good bet. And so this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about stuff where it's not that you abandon efficiency, right? Efficiency is good. It's that if we're talking about a 3% reduction in efficiency, or sorry, a 3% reduction in inefficiency, but that comes at the cost of catastrophic risk, that's a very bad bet to make. And a lot of what I think we're doing in the modern world is going for shaving off that last little bit and creating and embedding catastrophic risk into our systems. So, you know, this is the stuff where you're trying to find a way to have efficiency without catastrophic risk. Now, this means that you need to find ways to reward politicians who plan for the future. And democracy has problems with this because even though I'm a very big proponent of democracy, but one inbuilt problem of democracy is that, you know, if you have a politician who plans for 10 or 15 years in the future, they're possibly giving their opponent a gift, right? Because the person who's going to benefit from that is potentially from the rival party. So we have to find a way as societies to demand planning of our politicians. It's, you know, we have a lot of other pressing problems, but this is one of them. In the individual lives, I mean, this is where writing this book changed my worldview quite profoundly, in a sort of individual way. I was living what I would sort of disparagingly describe as a checklist existence, you know, sort of life hacks. How can I be more efficient? You know, this sort of stuff. And I realized that, like, it's a never-ending treadmill that never gets you anywhere, right? Like, if you get like a little bit more efficient in your life hack or your to-do list is finished, there's going to be another to-do list, right? And you always sort of are putting off what is actually resilient, which is the moment, right? Like living, and I know it sounds cliche, but sort of just enjoying the world that we live in. I think a lot of people who are trying to squeeze out that efficiency and optimization are imagining that if they only get that little extra bit, then everything will be fine and it never arrives, right? So to me, after writing this book, I think what I've done differently in my own life is I don't sweat the efficiency stuff quite so much, and I go for more walks, and I hang out with my dog, even if I have stuff to do, and my inbox is overflowing, you know? And, you know, this is the kind of stuff where it's trying to find a way to just sort of say that this is the most resilient thing, right? No one can take away from you, barring a health catastrophe, that you can go for a walk and enjoy it. And I think so much of what we're told about the world is like, if you just control more of it, if you just have more stuff or more status, everything will be fine. And that's the corollary of the optimization existence, whereas the resilience corollary in individual lives to me is finding things that, whether there's a pandemic, whether you lose all your money, et cetera, you still derive meaning from it. And that's basically people and something that you find passion in. And so I think the people and passion is a much better strategy than stuff and status, and that creates more resilience.
One other thing that you mentioned in your book, and this has to do perhaps with some of the models that people use. You mentioned there's the phrase, all models are wrong, but some are useful. That is to say, if we really can't predict the future, what's the point on relying on imperfect data or models?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things I'd say about this. One is that there are some things that are, I borrow from this in the book as well, this phrase, radical uncertainty. And radical uncertainty is a world in which you cannot forecast the future no matter what data you have. For example, if somebody asks you, what will the world be like in 2100? There's no model that's going to get that right, no matter how much data we collect. We just can't forecast that. Chaos theory makes that impossible. Whereas questions about, like, you know, which intervention makes the best outcomes for cancer, yeah, more data will help. So there's different kinds of problems. When you get into the world of radical uncertainty, that's when it's really stupid to model on questions that you don't have to answer. So, like, if I'm trying to forecast what the inflation rate will be in Malawi in 2035, the answer is I don't know. That's the only defensible answer. The model, you can add more and more data to it, it's going to be wrong because the world's going to be different in 2035 and we can't anticipate it. I mean, every forecast in 2019 was completely wrong about the world in 2020 because of the pandemic, right? The world changed. So I separate out questions that we have to answer, like what should we do in a medical context when we don't know what underlying mysterious disease is causing the problem? You still have to make a guess. And so you model it, even though it's imperfect, compared to questions where we simply cannot know. And I think that's where we have to sometimes acknowledge the limits of our understanding, where you just say, I don't know. And because of that storytelling animal instinct, you can't say, I don't know, right? Like when somebody asks you a question, it's bad TV and it's bad punditry to say, I don't know. But honestly, that's the answer most of the time. And so we end up getting, like, sort of reflected at us this overly certain depiction of the world from the experts or the pundits, when in fact, you know, the real answer is we don't know. And I think it's healthy as a society to try to say that more often. And I try to do that when I'm asked about polling, for example.
And you mentioned in your book how, you know, Nate Silver's predictions in 2016 have a sort of, shall we say, bogus clarity that doesn't line up with how it works to run into the future that way. Do you find yourself telling other people on other shows that they don't know what they're saying?
Yeah, I mean, you want to not be a jerk, right? So,
right. Sure.
So, but I mean, what I do sometimes try to say is, like, look, like, you know, the people who come on with certainty and say this is going to happen, forecasting 6 months into the future, I don't know what's going to happen in American politics tomorrow. And I think I think the problem with the hubris that exists is that if you imagine the world as this sort of data set, which is just going to be tamed as we get better supercomputers and better data, then you're overly confident and you manipulate the world with a level of hubris that is dangerous. If you sort of say, like, look, there's a lot of stuff we don't understand, you'll experiment more and you'll be less certain about the interventions you have and you'll do trial and error more. So I think there's actually something quite important about how we reflect the nature of reality at people. And when we go on shows and talk about, yes, this is definitely going to happen, we're actually doing viewers a disservice by making them believe that things are under control in a way that may not. So I think there's an aspect of, like, sort of imagining that the data and the science is revealing the world rather than saying, hold on, we're affecting the systems that we're measuring. And so I think that's, you know, it's very, very important to articulate the limits of our understanding and not fall into the trap of the hubris.
You were just listening to Brian Kloss on Chaos, Chance, and Choice. He spoke at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota in mid-May 2024. Brian Kloss is professor of global politics at the University College London and author of Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Michael Parenti, Thomas Suarez, Naomi Klein, Ilan Pape, Medea Benjamin, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Brian Kloss, on Chaos, Chance, and Choice, and for his book, Fluke. Call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Chris Brunel. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Dan Byrne. God Said No.
I met God on the edge of town, where the wind meets the stillness, where the darkness meets the light, where the ocean meets the sky, where the desert meets the rain, where the earth meets the heavens, on the edge of town, I met God. I asked God, do one thing for me, send me back in time, send me to Seattle, let me go find Kurt Cobain.
Good morning, it's Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. We just danced our way awake with Soul Makassa.
Yeah, I'm a young black man who uses art to champion and celebrate blackness, as well as creating art that showcases black men as comprehensive, emotionally intelligent human beings.
Right now, we are going to hear a spoken word rap piece by Slam Poetry winner JB, the First Lady. That is Lady Johnny Proby singing Don't Quit, and here at Speak Up, we do not quit.
Love, laughter, argument, and encouragement. The words are too few for the essence of you.
And it shows just one of the ways that you can take feelings of pain and transform them to love and recognition.
Today, we're exploring senior issues through digital media and the creative arts. My guests are Leslie Riemann, the director of the 411 Center, and Joel Flynn from Podstream.
This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, welcoming you to the Friday Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show. We have conversations about social issues, culture, and creative arts events, potent samplings about special months like Health Month, Black History Month, Women's Month, Nutrition Month, and more. See you Friday at 10 a.m.